Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show by discussing the $1 trillion infrastructure package and the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill. We will also talk about the extension of the eviction moratorium and bring you an update on Chantel Brown's victory in the primary race for Ohio's 11th congressional district. As we reported on Wednesday, 13 Democrats were on the ballot, but the front runners were Chantel Brown and Nina Turner. And our guest said that this race will further determine the future of the Democratic Party. Joining us is David Dayan, the executive editor of the American Prospect and author of Monopolized, Life in the Age of Corporate Power. David is also author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. That won the Studs and Ida Turkle Prize. David Dayan was also the winner of the 2021 Hillman Prize for Excellence in Magazine Journalism. David, thanks so much for joining us again, and congrats on all of these great awards.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on again.
Well, it's great to have you. Let's begin by talking about the Chantel Brown Nina Turner race. Because the district is solidly Democratic in Ohio, it includes Cleveland, Chantel Brown is almost certainly going to Congress. She had support from Hillary Clinton, Representative James Clyburn, the Congressional Black Caucus. According to reports, the Democratic majority for Israel Super PAC spent $2 million on ads mostly attacking Nina Turner, who had support from Senator Bernie Sanders, a number of progressives, and the Working Families Party. David, your colleague Alexander Salmon wrote a really interesting piece called Nina Turner Lost to the Red Box. Can you tell us about that piece?
Yeah, sure. Super PACs are not supposed to be able to coordinate with candidates. That's one of the main restrictions there. They're supposed to be completely independent of the candidate. But candidates increasingly have found ways around this restriction. And one of the ways they do it is with the so-called red box. So on Chantel Brown's campaign website, there was this series of talking points that was enveloped in a red box described a various bit of messages that Brown wanted to pursue against Nina Turner, and also said that, you know, voters needed to hear and see and read about these particular comments. And this is seen in sort of the political industry as a signal to super PAC groups that those are the messages that the candidate wants you to use. And sure enough, the Democratic majority for Israel, who ran these $2 million worth of ads, used those exact messages, which I should say have nothing to do with Israel policy, in their campaigns. And they used them in the precise ways that Brown suggested, through mailers, through television ads, through radio and what have you. So this does really skirt the line of illegal campaign coordination between a candidate and a super PAC. And so it was it may be the most brazen use of this that we've seen yet.
One of the important points that your colleague makes in this piece, and we'll put this at yourcallradio.org again, Alexander Salmon, writes, the Democratic Party has reached a low moment in its commitment to campaign finance standards. Predictably, campaign finance reform has functionally disappeared from the docket of legislative priorities. And while the party has abandoned its credibility in talking about campaign finance reform, a move that has proved fruitful in helping moderates best progressives, there's no indication that that will do anything to help Democrats beat Republicans in the fast approaching gerrymandered midterms, which are looking more daunting by the day.
Yeah. So we saw this trajectory in the 2020 presidential primaries, where first everybody came out and said, I will discourage the use of a super PAC on my behalf. That's not what the Democratic Party stands for. And then, of course, the first person to break that pledge was Joe Biden, who got support from a super PAC before she exited the race. Kamala Harris reportedly had, there were super PACs on her behalf that had already cut ads and were ready to deploy them. And Pete Buttigieg, who's now the transportation secretary, used this kind of red box messaging. He actually put a message on Twitter, I believe, from a campaign official saying that, you know, voters needed to hear the message that Buttigieg used in Iowa, and they need to hear it in Nevada, and they need to hear it in the week before the caucus. And that's exactly what a super PAC did, vote vets PAC, in that election. So you by the end of the 2020 primaries, practically every major candidate was enjoying the support of super PACs, including Elizabeth Warren. And so you just sort of saw this devolution of the campaign finance pledges that the presidential candidates made. And of course, that's the lead that's now being followed by House members and Senate and what have you.
And one more important point on this, because we're already seeing dark money flow into campaigns. Alexander Salmon wrote that given the Democratic majority for Israel has been funded by donors who routinely give to Republican causes and candidates, Chantel Brown just created a roadmap for Republican takeover of Democratic elections, and Democratic leadership sanctified it.
I mean, certainly Brown's support, which really bolstered her. She was well behind in the fundraising chase against Turner. She would not have had parity and indeed more ads in this race, more money to spend, without the support of these super PACs. And Democratic majority for Israel in particular has been playing in a lot of these progressive versus moderate primary races. And yes, they do enjoy the support of individual donors who normally support Republicans. So yeah, there is this tendency here, and they've become a major player in it. And we're going to have to see how that progresses as the primaries continue in 2022.
Well, a huge thanks to your colleague Alexander Salmon at the American Prospect for writing this, because it is so important to follow the money. Now let's talk about the expiration of the eviction moratorium. And a few hours after our show aired on Wednesday, the CDC announced a 2-month extension, but it only applies to counties experiencing high or substantial community COVID spread. Many reports out there say that this has fueled so much confusion. The extension is too late for some. David, you wrote a really important piece about the $46 billion in emergency rental relief Congress has allocated. And so far, only $3 billion has been dispersed. You write that if that money was parceled out at even a somewhat reasonable rate, there would be no crisis at all. So what happened here?
This is another one where you have to follow the money, right? And in this case, you have to follow the money that didn't get to its intended target. And this is an old story where we have social welfare benefits that are very hard to access. So the way that they set up this federal rental assistance program, they had two tranches. There was $21 billion that was given at the beginning of the year, actually at the end of 2020. And the American Rescue Plan added another $25.5 billion onto that. So you have $46.5 billion available. By all accounts, the amount of rental debt people, you know, who have back rent that's due is about $21 or $22 billion. So this should be more than enough to cover those arrears. And yet, almost none of it has gone out. So why is that? Well, it's not a federal program. It's a program that the Treasury Department has given money to states and cities who have to set up entirely new rental assistance programs that didn't exist before, come up with a way to promote them, though there's no money that's been appropriated in the program for education and outreach. They have to set up under the parameters of the program. There are certain income requirements and verifications that indeed you owe this back debt. So it's somewhat complicated. Every local and state program is administering this in a different way. I have heard about paperwork burdens on the part of renters. It's very hard to get this relief. It's very hard to figure out the application. There are no navigators to work with people through these applications. And then there's another part of this where landlords can actually deny the relief. They can reject it. They can reject the relief coming directly from the agency that has been set up, the grantee, with this grant money. And at that point, the agency has to give the money directly to the renter, and the renter has to then give it to pay off their back rent. And it's cumbersome, and it's just another step in this process. So the sum total of this is that it was a poorly designed program, and it's also been a poorly implemented program. And that's why you have 6% of the total amount available that has been distributed in 6 months. So if you just sort of extend that out, you wouldn't have this money released in until 2028 completely. And we're 2 months away from yet another deadline in terms of the moratorium, and maybe even sooner if the Supreme Court acts and strikes down this moratorium as unconstitutional. So the real problem here is that Congress appropriated the money to solve this potential tragedy of millions of people being kicked out of their homes, but they didn't pay attention to how the program was constructed and how the program has been implemented. And now everybody's scrambling to try to figure out how to get that done.
Can you tell us what went on behind the scenes? Who constructed the program?
Well, this initially was part of the year-end bill while Trump was still president and while Republicans still held the Senate. And so certainly they had a say in it, in addition to Democrats in the House. It's unclear exactly who wrote the bill necessarily, but I can tell you that there's not a whole lot of difference between the struggles that we see on something like this and the struggles that we see to access benefits on a whole host of other programs that are delivered. It's just hard for poor and vulnerable people to access this money that they're eligible to. And it's not just rental assistance. It's the child tax credit. If you don't file taxes, which is what most poor people in the United States don't, it's very hard to figure out how to get onto the IRS website and fill out the form that you need to fill out in order to become eligible for that. There's a program for emergency broadband assistance that was in the March American Rescue Plan. That's also been a barrier. In all three of those cases, less than one in 10 eligible people have actually received the relief. And so you have to see this as a pattern. And the pattern really is that we make it to be a huge hassle for people to access things that they're eligible to get. We turn people into little bureaucrats because we've hollowed out the administrative state so much. It falls to the individual to fill out forms and get on the phone and all of these things, which represent really a tax on people's free time. I mean, we're doing the job that government should be doing to distribute this relief, but it falls to the individual to double check and come up with all these forms to file to fill out and all of these things that are completely unnecessary, and they hinder the actual relief that to get distributed, and even more so they project a position of government that is difficult to scale, that doesn't seem to be working in people's interests. The faster and more efficient that you deliver this relief, the more people think like government is on their side. And when you do it in such a way that's difficult, you get the exact opposite impression.
David, well, I want to give a shout out to librarians, because librarians have written us in the past and said, if you've got questions with these kinds of things, call your local librarian. Not saying that they're going to have all the information on all of this, but if you do hit a roadblock, you might just want to call your librarian, because they do amazing work. I just want to ask you before we get to infrastructure, is it safe to say that if it was not for Representative Cori Bush camping out on the Capitol steps, the moratorium extension probably would not have happened?
I think that is safe to say. And certainly the powerful way in which she conducted that and used her personal experience of previously being homeless was a major factor in raising the pressure on the Biden administration, who previously had said at the end of June that they weren't going to extend this any more than through the end of July. It did move them to act. However, it's going to take more in these next 60 days if we're not going to see yet another deadline that will lead to yet another crisis. It's going to take more than just Biden and Senate Majority Leader Schumer and Speaker Pelosi to just browbeat state and local agencies who are unequipped to really deal with the crush of applications to just get the money out. Like, more needs to be done here. And it should have been done with a change in mindset from the very beginning, not to federalize this program, to kind of pass the buck to the states and cities, to universalize these programs in some fashion so that income tests are not a part of this in this thing, and just better manage the distribution of relief. I mean, it's one thing for Congress to say, hey, we see a problem coming and here's $46.5 billion to solve that problem. But if the money can't actually get out, then that law is just a piece of paper.
Today, we're speaking with David Dayan, who is executive editor of The American Prospect. David is author of really great books, Monopolize, Life in the Age of Corporate Power and Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. And if you'd like to join us, any comments or questions about media coverage of these issues, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have a caller on the Nina Turner-Chantel Brown race, Brad in Columbus, Ohio. Hi, Brad. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. But I don't know if I'm absolutely on for that issue. I just wanted to add that nothing's going to change in our voting system and the way our government runs until we stop making government a business and running for elections also a business. It's a capitalist free enterprise. And you can't expect anyone who wants to participate it to not be part of it until we take action to change that, which would take quite a long time, I agree. But however, elections should be run on a very shortened basis. Everyone should be allowed to vote. The fairness doctrine would be a good place to start to get information out to the public. But right now, as I said, it's just a business. And it would take a generation or two to change it, unfortunately. I don't think it'll be changed at the snap of a fingers, because there's going to be too much pushback to make that change immediate.
Well, thank you for that comment, Brad. David, any comments?
Yeah, I mean, if you don't want to make elections a business, then what you have to do is create a public financing system so that people who want to be public servants don't have to become telemarketers, essentially, and call up rich people for hours and hours a day in order to get the funds that are needed to run an election. So, I think ultimately that has got to be the end goal. Unfortunately, we're stalled on HR 1, which would create some form of a public financing system in the United States. And, that I think is going to be the main obstacle.
Well, thanks for the call, Brad. I know we've got 5 minutes left with you, David, so let's turn to the $1 trillion infrastructure package. According to the latest reports, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer scheduled an important vote for Saturday. Last night, right before midnight, he said, "We've been trying to vote on amendments all day, but have encountered a number of objections from the other side. We want to finish. Show will reconvene on Saturday." Is that the latest?
Yeah. Yes, I believe there's been 22 separate amendments that have been voted upon on the infrastructure package, and that's a large number in relative terms. Under Mitch McConnell, there were virtually no amendments that were ever given to the other side. So Schumer obviously believes that he's operated in good faith and that they can move on with the bill. I suspect that they will get cloture on Saturday and that sometime next week this bill will have passed the Senate. Of course, what the House continues to maintain is that they're not going to pass a bipartisan bill until they get the Senate to pass that reconciliation bill. And then they will only, you know, work with those two bills in tandem.
So this $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill has investments for childcare, education, climate. Progressives are really pushing this one hard. And yet Senator Kristen Sinema, Democrat from Arizona, says she's not going to support a reconciliation bill of that size. So give us a sense of what you think will happen with this.
Well, what she didn't say is that she would she didn't say that she would reject and oppose the budget resolution. So it's a kind of a two-step process here. The first thing you do is you pass a budget resolution that says we can create a reconciliation bill of up to $3.5 trillion. And then the second thing you do is that reconciliation bill. So Sinema is not blocking the first step. The first step is the budget resolution. That's what's going to get done, you know, sometime in August by the Senate. The actual hashing out of what that reconciliation bill looks like is going to be reserved until the fall. And so we're putting off the final battle here between Sinema and other moderates and progressives in terms of what that reconciliation bill will look like.
Did we just lose David? David, are you still there? Hello, David. We're still working from home and we're connecting on Zoom. So let's see if we can get David back. Kevin, can you let me know if David is on? David, are you with us? All right. Well, I'm just going to read a little bit here and hopefully David's connection will come back. So let's see here. In terms of reconciliation, David writes, well, let's talk about climate really quickly here. So this bill is 2,702 pages. David Dayan writes that the bill is unlikely to reverse a drastic trajectory on climate, but we can say that the legislation would likely return the United States to something closer to an industrialized nation in its built environment. Do we have David on? I really wanted to ask him about climate before we end because... Mm-hmm. Oh, David, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. So before we let you go, the Dixie Fire in California just ravaged the town of Greenville in Plumas County on Wednesday. The main street was just left in smoky piles of rubble, which is absolutely just devastating. What will this infrastructure package do for the climate crisis? David? All right. I'm sorry. I think we're having some technical issues. Well, we're going to have to say goodbye to David Dayan. And David, are you there?
Yeah. I can. Can you hear me?
Okay, go ahead. Yeah, you can just tell us about climate, and then we'll let you go.
Yeah, briefly. I mean, the climate related issues in this particular bipartisan bill have been chopped down, but a lot of them are expected to come up again potentially in the reconciliation bill. The biggest one being the clean electricity standard, which would set a goal of, I believe, 80%. Of all electricity from renewable sources by 2030, might be 2035, but it's somewhere in that range. Yesterday, the Biden administration set a goal of clean cars, electric vehicles, half of all new sales by 2030, 2035. So, I do think that there isn't a whole lot in the bipartisan bill that's going to really change the game on climate. There's the potential for some things in the reconciliation bill to do so, but clearly we need more pressure to force the political system to see everything that we've seen this summer, from the Pacific Northwest to the fires in Northern California, to the flooding in Europe, to stuff on the Gulf Coast. We just had a great piece about Lake Charles, Louisiana, which had four severe weather events in the space of 9 months. All of those things, the nature, Mother Nature is screaming out for a fix here, for help to mitigate the climate crisis, and the political system needs to catch up to that.
David Dayan is executive editor of The American Prospect and author of Monopolized Life in the Age of Corporate Power. Be sure to check out his pieces and his colleagues at yourcallradio.org. David, as always, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
All right. Thanks. And sorry for the technical difficulties.
No problem. Thank you. And yeah, well, we should apologize also. You never know when we're going to get these internet issues happening with our calls, since we're all in different places. Coming up after a break, we will talk about journalism's critical role during the COVID pandemic. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.